Before the rabbi begins, it's our sort of customary now to give a quick intro on the parashat, only this time it's slightly different in that we're giving the end, which we missed last week, the last parashat in Numbers previous, and this sets the scene for today's talk. The Torah, towards the end of Numbers, recounts the journeys of the Jews in the desert, and indeed there are accounts of the 42 journeys over their 40 years of wandering until the banks of the River Jordan are reached, where they are now. This land, the promised land, the borders are delineated and divided by lottery, between the 9.5 tribes waiting to go across the Jordan to take the promised land. Do remember, of course, as we mentioned last week, that the tribes of Reuben and Gad, plus half a tribe of Manasseh, decided they would stay on the east bank of the Jordan rather than travelling across. God then appoints a representative from each of the tribes to divide the land up before they go across to take it, which is a real confidence in God. Next, the Jews are commanded, when they get across, to give the Levites 48 cities where they could dwell and live. 42 cities plus, strangely, 6 cities of refuge. 6 cities of refuge, which would be designated when they got across. Along with these cities, the Levites were given land round about them. So they were provided for separately from the tribes. Then the Jews are commanded to name these 6 these cities of refuge, and they're entailed in that is an interesting mitzvah, an interesting one, in that these cities, 6 cities, will offer refuge to a person who accidentally kills someone. We don't do this mitzvah today, as you know. For instance, if you chop down a tree, say, if you chopped a tree down and it fell on your neighbour, fell on someone, then you could dash off to a city of refuge and stay there. And then, of course, the relatives of the dead man, who whatever would be after the blood, would not be allowed to harm you. And there you would remain until, unless you were stupid enough to go beyond the city boundaries, and then you'd be, you'd have had it. They'd have got you, the relatives. You have to stay there until the death of the serving high priest, which could be a long time, if he was a young priest. The Jews are urged not to take blood money. They were told, don't take blood money from the murderer, simply to lighten the murderer's sentence. Now, in last week's reading, God, and this is interesting and important, God instructs Moses to give the daughters of the deceased, dead Zelophehad, his portion in the land of Israel. The daughters, first time, get a portion. The elders of Zelophehad now protest that this could cause the possible transferring of land from the portion of their tribes to another tribe if they married out. God therefore instructs Zelophehad's daughters to marry men from within their own tribe. And that way, of course, the land they inherit will remain with their ancestral tribe. And that's your lot on that one. Rabbi, come forth.
And of course, so that brings us, get into my laptop here. That brings us up to date with Sefer Bamidbar, Sefer Devarim. Get that right. So we're going to dive deep into Sefer Devarim this morning. And we should begin, as we should do with any reading any book, particularly scriptures, by looking at the provenance of the book. It will help us to understand the contents of Sefer Devarim if we can appreciate, first of all, who wrote it, when it was written, and why it was written. Now, perhaps to some here this morning, these questions are simply to you asking the bleedingly obvious. After all, everyone knows that Moses wrote it, don't they? And it's certainly true that while the Mosaic authorship of Devarim is commonly held, particularly in Orthodox Jewish and evangelical Christian quarters, you'll be hard-pressed to find that statement in the book itself, because it's not in Devarim. Indeed, the internal evidence of Sefer Devarim suggests that it wasn't written by Moses. Not that doesn't mean it doesn't contain Moses' words, but he didn't write it. Devarim 34, verses 5 to 7 states, for example, "Then Moshe, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His sight was unimpaired and his vigor had not abated." So even the most ardent believer in the Mosaic authorship of Sefer Devarim must admit it's going to be hard for Moses to write about his own death. So somebody else wrote that. Indeed, I'm also struck by two statements in our opening paragraph of this week's portion. Statements which obviously help to set up the framework for what follows in the book. And so we read, "Ele ha-devarim," these are the words, "asher diber," that Moses spoke, "el kol Yisrael," to all Israel, "be'eva ha-yaden, ba-midbar ba-arava, mol-suf ben-paran u-vein tofel, ve-lefan ve-chatzorot ve-di-zahav." I'll say it again, but in English. These are the words that Moses addressed to all Israel on the other side of the Jordan, through the wilderness, in the Arabah, near Suf, between Paran and Tophel, Levan, Hatzeroth, and Dizahav. And again, in verse 5, we are also again told, "On the other side of the Jordan, in the land of Moab, Moshe undertook to expound this teaching." Now, it's entirely possible, I'm sure, for people to read Sefer Devarim or any other biblical book of the Bible many times over and miss small details. But small details like those verses have huge implications. Because obviously the statement, "on the other side of the Jordan," means that whoever was writing these words was situated in the land of Israel, writing about events that had happened already on the other side of the Jordan in the wilderness. And in other words, since Moses had already died and never got in the promised land, these words were not written by Moses. Just like he couldn't write about his own death, so also he couldn't have written these words. Now, a traditional response to these anomalies or apparent anomalies in the text is to suggest that, well, if it wasn't Moses, it must have been Yehoshua then. Because that, of course, has the benefit of keeping the writer of Sefer Devarim close in spirit and in time to Moshe. Because as Devarim 34 verse 9 says, "Yehoshua son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom because Moshe had laid his hands on him and the Israelites obeyed him, doing as the Lord had commanded Moshe." So it's a neat idea, it's nice if we can have Yehoshua then being the one who's writing this book. But there's a problem with this from the actual text itself. As we read in Devarim 34 verse 10, it says, "Never since has there arisen a prophet in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face." And of course, this statement would be pretty meaningless if Yehoshua was the author of Sefer Devarim, because how many years had elapsed since Moshe had died? Very few. It's a pointless, meaningless statement. And to the contrary, the statement would suggest that a considerable period of time must have passed since Moses' death before Sefer Devarim was actually written. So we're starting to get internal evidence from the scripture itself, from Devarim, about the authorship of this book. And in our portion, Devarim 2 verse 12, for instance, we read, and I quote, "Moreover, the Horim had formerly inhabited Seir, but the descendants of Esau dispossessed them, destroying them and settling in their place as Israel had done in the land that the Lord gave them as a possession." Note those words, as Israel had done in the land that the Lord gave them as a possession. In other words, the conquest has already happened. The author describes the conquest of the land as something that has happened in the past. By definition, this therefore must have been written after Joshua, after Yehoshua and the conquest period, after Yehoshua has died. So it couldn't have been Yehoshua that wrote Sefer Devarim. And moreover, Devarim 3:11, part of our portion, also adds, "Now only King Og of Bashan," I love that name, Og, "King Og of Bashan," it's like something from Jackanory, isn't it? Something like that. The younger ones are thinking, what is Jackanory? "Now only King Og of Bashan was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. In fact, his bed, an iron bed, can still be seen in Rabbah of the Ammonites." As Professor Christopher Rolston comments in an article on a fantastic, it's an Orthodox website, thetorah.com, and I quote, "The text refers to Og's enormous bed as being in the capital city of Ammon, Rabbah. How did it get there? Would it not have been in Og's palace in the Bashan, now Israelite territory? This implies that the author is living at a much later time and that the bed has somehow made its way from the Bashan to Rabbah and is on display there for any who care to see." I love that. A museum to Og, king of Bashan. There is much more than we could say about this. Looking internally in Sefer Devarim for textual evidence of the authorship of the book. But the book itself actually doesn't tell us who wrote it. Time doesn't suffice to continue looking at those, but needless to say, I think we can quite confidently assert, even from what we've just looked at, that Moshe did not write Sefer Devarim. Doesn't mean his words aren't contained within it, but he's not the one, like the Gospels, where, you know, Yeshua did not write the Gospels. He's not the one that's writing it. It's written later on. And in fact, from the internal evidence of the book, it's likely that Sefer Devarim doesn't date at all from the 13th century BCE. That is contained contemporaneously with Moshe and Yehoshua and the conquest period. But most probably dates from in and around the 7th century BCE. And that is sometime in between the fall of the northern Israelite kingdom, but before the fall of the southern kingdom. As Bernard Levinson, an eminent professor of classical and Near Eastern studies, has written in the introduction to Sefer Devarim in the Jewish Study Bible, and I quote, "Deuteronomy is likely not Mosaic in origin, although Moses didn't write it. More probably, the core of the book was written sometime during the 7th century BCE by educated scribes associated with Jerusalem's royal court. It has long been recognized that there are very striking similarities between the distinctive religious and legal requirements of Deuteronomy and the account of the major religious reform carried out by King Josiah in 622 BCE. When he says distinctive religious requirements, legal requirements, that's because there are some differences between the laws in Deuteronomy and the laws in the first four books. That reform, it continues, had been inspired by the discovery in the temple of, quote, a scroll of the teaching, that's 2 Kings 22, verse 8. Josiah's reform, in Hebrew we refer to him as Yoshiyahu, Josiah's reform restricted all sacrificial worship of God to Jerusalem and removed foreign elements from the system of worship, technically the cultus. And it culminated in the celebration of the first nationally centralized Passover at the temple in Jerusalem, as recorded in 2 Kings chapters 22 to 23. So strongly, he continues, do these royal initiatives correspond to the distinctive requirements of Deuteronomy that scholars have long identified, quote, the scroll of the Torah discovered in Josiah's temple as Deuteronomy, and thus have assigned the book a 7th century date. So that's 5 centuries after Moshe and Yehoshua. The discovery of, quote, the scroll of the Torah reported in Malachim Bet in 2 Kings has always been something of a curiosity to me. And as you read the story, they're doing some repairs on the temple, and a priest finds this scroll. You remember the story. It says, Hilkiahu, the Kohen HaGadol, the high priest, said to Shaphan, the secretary, I have found the scroll of the Torah in the house of Adonai. Hilkiah gave the scroll to Shaphan, who read it. Shaphan, the secretary, told the king, Hilkiah, the Kohen HaGadol, gave me a scroll. Then Shaphan read it aloud to the king, Naomi. Then Shaphan read it aloud before the king. After the king had heard what was written in the scroll of the Torah, he tore his clothes. Then the king issued this order to Hilkiah the Kohen, Ahikam the son of Shaphan, Achbor the son of Michaiah, Shaphan the secretary, and Asaiah the king's servant, go and consult Adonai for me, for the people and for all Yehuda in regard to what is written in the scroll which has been found. For Adonai must be furious at us, since our ancestors did not listen to the words written in the scroll and didn't do everything written there that concerns us. So Hilkiyahu the Kohen, Akikam, Achbor, Shaphan, and Asaiah went to Huldah the prophet, the wife of Shalom the son of Tikva, the son of Harkas, keeper of the wardrobe. She lived in the second quarter of Jerusalem and spoke with her. She told them, Adonai the God of Israel says to tell the man who sent you to me that Adonai says this, I am going to bring calamity on this place and on its inhabitants. Every word in the scroll the king of Yehuda has read, because they have abandoned me and offered to other gods in order to provoke me with everything they do. Therefore my anger will burn against this place and will not be quenched. But you are to tell the king of Yehuda who sent you to consult Adonai that Adonai your God of Israel also says this, in regard to the words you have heard, because your heart was tender and you humbled yourself before Adonai when you heard what I said against this place and its inhabitants, that they would become an object of astonishment and cursing and have torn your clothes and cried before me, I have also heard you, says Adonai. Therefore I will gather you to your ancestors. You will go to your grave in peace and your eyes will not see all the calamity I'm going to bring on this place. And this, when I've read that story in the past, it's caused me some wonderment. How could you lose the Torah? I mean, you know what? I thought God would be angry at them losing the Torah. But apparently he's not angry about that. He's angry that they've not been keeping it. But how could they lose it? How could they lose the scriptures? Well, it's not all of the scriptures. It's this one scroll that they're talking about here. Remember, the scriptures were written on separate scrolls in those days. The innovation of putting onto one whole scroll is a more recent one. So how was it possible that they could lose the Torah? Well, I don't think they did. And then again, therefore, that perhaps the scroll that discovered was this scroll of Devarim. As the Jewish Study Bible boldly declares, and I quote, the contents of this scroll and Josiah's and the people's reaction to it suggests that it was some form of the book of Deuteronomy, the book that was found, but it had only just been written. Richard Friedman is equally as bold. He says the book that the priest Hilkiah said he found in the temple in 622 BCE was Deuteronomy. And in fact, many others, such as the early church fathers, including Jerome, has also said that the book that was read to King Yoshiyahu was Deuteronomy, was Devarim. And modern scholarship also concurs with the findings of one W.M.L. Devet, who in the early part of the 19th century investigated the origins of Devarim. And Devet said that Devarim was not an old Mosaic book, it wasn't written by Moses, that had been lost for a long time and then found by the priest Hilkiah. Devarim, Devet said, was written not long before it was found in the temple. And the finding was something of a charade. The book was written, he continues, to provide grounds for Josiah's religious reform. As Friedman continues, for example, the first commandment in the law code of Deuteronomy is to sacrifice to God only at a single place. Josiah did just that. He tore down all the places of worship outside of the temple. But this brought all the influence and income of the religion to the Jerusalem priesthood. And it was a Jerusalem temple priest who had found the book. And let's not also forget, Yoshiahu, King Josiah, had been raised by the priests. He was their boy. He was a young boy at the age of 8, and he was looked after by these Jerusalem priests. Was centralization of worship an old practice, Friedman continues, that had been lost some generations before Josiah, or was it something new, conceived by the priestly leaders of Josiah's own time to justify a religious reform that was in their own interest? Devet pointed out that in the books of Samuel and Kings, the early figures in Israel's history know nothing of any centralization law. Samuel, the prophet, priest, judge, who anoints Saul and David, sacrificed in more than one place. So he didn't know about this centralization law. The first three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon, also sacrificed at altars in various places. The text of the history in the books of Samuel and Kings, nonetheless, he continues, does not criticize Samuel, Saul, David, or Solomon for this at all. Devet concluded that from the earliest period of the history of the people in the land, there was no evidence of the existence of a law requiring that worship be only in one central place. From the law of centralization and other matters, Devet concluded that the book of Deuteronomy was not a long-lost document, but rather was written not long before its discovery by Hilkiah. So it wasn't a very old document when it was found. And the purpose of Sefer Devarim, according to Devet, was to legitimize, to support the religious reforms that King Yoshiahu was in the process of making. And the effect of this was to elevate King Yoshiahu to star status among the priests. And let's not forget that he was raised by these priests, as if this king was a new incarnation of Moses himself. Devet went so far as to call the writing and discovery of Sefer Devarim a pious fraud, practiced both by the Jerusalem priests who likely also discovered it and who wrote it, and King Yoshiahu, the new best king since sliced bread, whose religious reforms Devarim endorsed. They're working hand in glove, he's suggesting. Now, these are very strong words. However, if Sefer Devarim did actually come about in this way, then perhaps we can find empathy and understanding with the motivations of king and priests in the pressing context of the time. To say that these southern Judeans were facing an existential crisis is to put it mildly, for they had recently witnessed the destruction of the northern kingdom. Thousands of refugees, Naomi, had fled south seeking succor in Yoshiahu's land, bringing with them horrendous tales of indiscriminate Assyrian slaughter, unspeakable barbarities, torture, rape, pillage, and deportation. And this relief from Nineveh portrays Assyrians impaling Israelites on spikes. It's a picture of the northern conquest. It's like something from some horrendous horror movie. That's what had happened in the north. And another one here, next one. Shows Assyrians counting the decapitated heads of their Israelite enemies. And indeed, the Assyrian wolves were already sniffing around the borders of the southern kingdom, looking for their next dinner. And so a state of absolute crisis prevailed in the south. Yoshiahu and the priests wondered what could be done to keep the enemy at bay. And naturally their thoughts turned heavenward. It was clear to them that the northern kingdom had fallen because of idolatry. And since the Assyrians were therefore obviously God's chosen instrument of punishment, both kings, king and priests therefore dedicated themselves to reforming the faith of the Judeans of Judah in the south. It was the only way of keeping the Assyrians at bay. Turn back to the Lord. Reform the faith. And so their purpose in all of this was simply to bring the people back to Hashem. Not only is Sefer Devarim conspicuous for its stress on the centralization of worship, as we heard, but at its core it's also a retributional theology, which states several blessings for obedience, but if you look at the text, places far greater stress on curses for disobedience. And this naturally reflected the state of crisis in the south, and their total fear of the existential threat from Assyria and then Babylon. This relative overemphasis on curses is itself reflected in the fact that while blessings for obedience are detailed in just 12 verses in Devarim 28, the curses for disobedience are almost five times longer. 53 verses for curses, only 12 for blessings. This is a people who are afraid of what's going to happen. The curses are very real to them. Indeed, as we read through those curses, it's possible to see very close parallels between the curses and what had happened in the north just recently. The imprecations of Devarim 28 were very real. The message of Sefer Devarim to the southerners was therefore clear. Turn back to the Lord. Be faithful to Hashem. Turn away from your idolatry. Support King Yoshiyahu in his reforms because he's been sent by God. Or the things that happened up north will happen to you. The chroniclers of the time lauded praise on Yoshiyahu for bringing the southern kingdom back to Hashem. Among all, if you read the books of 1 Kings and 2 Kings, they're just full of lots of lists of kings, and this was a bad king, and this he did evil in the sight of the Lord. And his son also followed in the ways of his father, doing evil in the sight of the Lord. But this king was a good king. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord. And you read through the list of kings, and there's either a thumbs up or a thumbs down from whoever's writing 1 and 2 Kings. And Josiah is singled out for fulsome praise that we don't find anywhere else in these two books. And so we read in 2 Kings 22 verse 2 that Yoshiyahu did what was right from Adonai's perspective, living entirely in the manner of David his ancestor and turning away neither to the right nor to the left. This is a statement that Yoshiyahu is almost the incarnation of King David. It's a statement of how great Yoshiyahu was being considered at that time. And moreover, Melachim Bet 25 verse 5 adds, no previous king was like him. No previous king was like him. Not even David. Not even Solomon. Because he turned to Adonai with all his heart, with all his being, and with all his power, in accordance with all the Torah of Moshe. Nor did any king like him arise afterwards. There was no king like him before, and no king like him afterwards. He's the best thing since sliced bread, this king. A resounding peal of approval of King Yoshiyahu from the chronicler of the time. And so why don't you know more about Yoshiyahu? Why don't we have huge sections devoted to him like we do with David and Solomon? If he was the best king ever, why don't you hear more about him? And that's because it all went a little bit wrong at the end. It's a great irony that in contradiction to all the promises of blessing in Sefer Devarim, King Yoshiyahu didn't even live past his 38th year. He was 38 years old when he died. Now surely, according to Sefer Devarim, long life and a peaceful kingdom should have been his for somebody who's the greatest king ever, even greater than David and Solomon, as we read in Naomi, I think we have a passage next. Put that up. The Lord will cause The enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you, they will march out against you from one direction, but flee from you in seven directions. That's there in Devarim, in the blessings that take up 12 verses, and there are obviously 53 verses of curses that come after that. But this is the promise for the person, for the person who fears Adonai and pursues him with all his heart, strength and might, and turns neither to the left nor to the right. And you can assume that this would happen for the king like whom there is no other king, the best king ever. Yet, King Yoshiyahu, this best king ever, was killed in battle by an Egyptian arrow while fighting at the Battle of Megiddo against the Egyptian pharaoh. Why isn't that fulfilled in King Yoshiyahu? Other more evil kings actually lived longer and reigned longer than Yoshiyahu. Why was that not fulfilled? And this salient fact, along with other biblical works of counter-testimony like Kohelet and Job, put the retributional theology of Sefer Devarim into some relief and should cause us to stop and think about how we interpret God's actions in our own lives today. You know, I've done this. If something goes wrong, I'm out of God's will. God's punishing me. Something's good, right? Good goes right. God's rewarding me for my righteousness. I'm doing something right. You know, we believers are very superstitious people. We interpret the signs of the times. If it's good, then God's blessing. If it's bad, God's cursing me. But the truth is that bad things do happen to good people. And good things happen to bad people. That's just how the cookie of life crumbles, says Kohelet, Ecclesiastes. He's looking at this blessings and curses theology of Deuteronomy and is saying, that's not what I see happening. That's not what they saw happening in Yoshiyahu either. As Kohelet argues, when good or bad things happen, it's not necessarily anything to do with what God is doing to you. And Yeshua concurred, saying that God, quote, makes his sun shine on good and bad people alike. So don't assume that just because things are going right for you that God is blessing you. Well, he is blessing you, but he's blessing also the bad people at the same time. And also he sends his rain to the righteous and the unrighteous alike. So God is not separating out good people or bad people for blessings and curses, according to Yeshua. Sefer Devarim's theology of blessings and curses, so particularly beloved of evangelical Christianity, you'll see them on the God Channel talking about us. This is how you get rich, apparently, according to a lot of these preachers. You know, just be faithful to the Lord, and he's going to bless you with riches and money and power and wealth. He wants you to be an example of his blessing. It was a product of its time. It was a product of the existential crisis of southern Israel. It was a desperate response to this Judean crisis, trying to ward off the impending doom, trying to stop what had happened in the north happening to them. And in the end, regardless of Yoshiyahu's reforms, he died. He was killed by an Egyptian arrow, and the southern kingdom fell, just as the northern kingdom had. And the truth is, it was a victim of the rapidly changing geopolitical realities of the ancient Middle East, in which small kingdoms, like Judah, simply couldn't find a space to exist anymore in the midst of mighty great empires like Assyria and Babylon and then Greece and then Rome. Small little kingdoms couldn't exist in that reality, and it was crushed. So we should think about how we, in this age, interpret our lives, blessings and curses. I'm sure we've all done this. It is a little bit superstitious to assume that just because the sun's shining today, or it's raining, or because good things have happened, I've won the lottery, that it's God that made you win the lottery. Or you didn't win the lottery, well, it's God that didn't make you win the lottery. As Kohelet says, That's just the way the cookie crumbles. And so what we need to do is dive deeper into the text and see where they came from. Why was this written in this way? Why were the words of Moses written in this way? Why were they phrased in this way? And that will give us more insight into our own lives in this 21st century. Amen.